Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Barron. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. Thank you very much, Eva, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm very much looking forward to talking to you today about the great work that you do at the Environmental Leadership and Training Initiative at Yale, at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Some of the projects you're involved in, particularly I'm interested in getting a sense of the way you approach conservation projects, restoration, and really also the role of local communities and people living in the community, which seems to be sometimes a neglected area. But can you maybe tell me a little bit about your background first and what you do?
Sure, absolutely. So my background is actually originally in political ecology and biology. And then I came to the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and got a master's and a doctoral degree in cultural anthropology, also focusing on political ecology.
And I know you've also been an advisor and researcher for conservation and restoration efforts at several places prior to the important work you're doing at ELTE. Now, the work at ELTE, your work bridges across the political and environmental and beyond. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. It is really looking at the relationships between the political, economic, and social factors with respect to environmental issues, and really focusing in on the role of power in and how power impacts the way we think about environmental problems and the solutions to those problems.
Very interesting. Because how would you say generally, how well integrated or included is power? It's an interesting point at the moment because quite a few environmental movements and some are addressing the question of power and others are saying, well, we don't want to go there. We don't want to get involved in that because I guess to some degree, power today also means thinking about capitalism to some degree.
Oh, absolutely. And I would argue that we can't think about solutions to the problems we're facing today with the environment without thinking about power. And it is the hardest component. But power causes, highly variable access to and control over natural resources. And if we don't address it, we're not going to understand the root causes of environmental problems. We will maybe identify problems inaccurately and then find solutions that actually don't address the problems. They could cause unintended consequences. They could just be a band-aid as things continue to spiral out of control, which is what I think has happened today. So I think I do understand how difficult it is to think about power dynamics, to think about sort of the people component. But without it, we're not going to get anywhere with the problems that we're facing.
Right, I'm surely come back to talk about this in a few minutes. Could you tell me a little bit about what I guess called ELTE, however you pronounce that? Yeah, what you're about there? I noted that it's in your restoration focus and conservation is in human dominated landscapes, and I'm just wondering why is that important? So if you could include something about that.
So ELTE is a program of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and we focus exclusively on capacity development in human-dominated or what people can also refer to as mosaic landscapes, multiple-use landscapes. So these are areas that were once forested or largely forested and are now a composite of different land use practices. So you'll have remnant trees in the landscape, forest fragments, but you're also going to have different scales of agricultural production. You'll have cattle ranching, mining, it really depends. So these are actually the landscapes where most of the world's biodiversity is located today. So tropical forests, we used to have intact, large, vast quantities of tropical forests. And now, interestingly, only about 9.8% of the entire tropical forest biome lies within strictly protected areas. And so what does that mean? It means that so much of the forest cover of biodiversity is outside of protected areas. And so we have to be really creative in the solutions and the way we approach conservation and restoration. And so that's something that is very unique to LT. We look at building capacity of people who are influencing or managing or depending upon these human-dominated mosaic tropical forest landscapes. We build their capacity to try to conserve and restore these landscapes, and doing so in ways that both support local livelihoods and also protect biodiversity. And so if we don't focus on these areas, we're going to lose a lot of what we have. And I'm not trying to negate the importance of protected areas and expanding protected areas. I think that's crucial, and there are many people who are focused on that. But what LT does is look beyond the protected area and really look at that matrix of very complicated landscapes where you have multiple issues going on, multiple needs, different stakeholders, people who are trying to extract from those landscapes, to subsist, to conserve, and those are the areas that we focus on.
Right, right. So does that include the Amazon?
Yes, absolutely. It's very interesting. People think about the Amazon and they think, you know, vast territory of intact tropical forests. Well, if you think about it, the Amazon has been inhabited by humans for hundreds of years, if not more. And so people have been impacting that landscape for a very long time. But even more so, there are cities in the Amazon. You know, there are very fragmented areas. You have, with cattle ranching and agricultural expansion, road development, the Amazon is becoming more and more fragmented. So there are many parts of the Amazon, yes, that are still intact, and people are trying to keep those intact and using strategies such as REDD+, which is reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, which is really trying to incentivize governments at different scales to keep forests intact. But in other parts of the Amazon, you have places that are highly fragmented, that are these mosaic landscapes. And so the efforts to try to increase tree and forest cover in those landscapes is crucial, and it's vital to trying to protect biodiversity and maintain ecosystem services.
Right. Now, that's very interesting, because presumably in these mosaic, and as you were saying, landscapes, there are multiple stakeholders with different needs, different rights, I suppose, and differential powers.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And so that's what I will go back to. You know, if you're looking at even in intact, you know, tropical forest landscapes where you have big, large tracts of tropical forest, people are contesting, you know, who owns and has the right to use and manage those resources. So the power aspects are critical. You'll have national governments that say they control forests and need to manage them, and then they can do what they want. They can give out forest concessions for mining and such. But then you have indigenous and other traditional communities that have lived within these natural resources and forests for millennia and are managing them and believe that they have access and rights to these areas. So the power dynamics are very complicated. When you go into these mosaic, you know, human-dominated landscapes where you do have multiple land use practices side by side or intertwined, it gets even more complicated. You have, for example, a landscape where LT works in Panama. This is a traditional cattle ranching landscape now, where you have different scales of cattle ranching going on, different forms of agricultural production. And so you have to address, you know, the very complicated cultural aspects of cattle ranching and all the pressures to deforest that area. You know, banks used to incentivize deforestation. So we have to think very carefully when we look at landscapes that are, you know, currently in a state that we think might not, you know, we would want them to be a little more forested or have more forest cover. You look at cattle ranchers and you can think, oh, these are the culprits, but they're working within a very complicated political, economic structure and system and making decisions that are very logical. And so I think that's the key to it. We have to understand what drives people's land use practices. Are we incentivizing deforestation? How do we stop that? And then we need to think about ways of trying to increase tree and forest cover, trying to protect biodiversity, but doing so in ways that support livelihoods. You can't, in these very complicated landscapes, you can't just dictate, you know, what should be and try to put forests back there. You really have to understand the history, the culture, the ecology, you know, what's driving land use practices, the power dynamics, who has control and how and why. And then we can start to think about solutions.
Right. A lot of ground you've covered there, which I'd love to talk about in more detail. I mean, firstly, maybe you could set the scene a little bit in terms of, you know, how well developed is our, you know, knowledge of how to go about, you know, conservation and restoration, and how has that developed? I mean, maybe in the last 20 or 30 years, just at a very high level. I mean, what one of the messages I get from you is about the community level and the indigenous peoples and this kind of bottom up kind of thing, which may have been neglected, I guess, in what would probably have been a more scientific type approach to these questions.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I think there's been just, you know, outstanding and exceptional scientific research, technical research about conservation and restoration of tropical forests and tropical forest landscapes. I think what is often not studied or recognized or understood are the social aspects and the political, cultural, economic aspects driving land use practices. So what I think needs to happen, well, let me take a step back. This is difficult data to gather. It requires, you know, cultural anthropologists, people who are trained in understanding culture and history and decision making, and it takes time to do these kinds of analyses. And so they are out there, but they're not many, and oftentimes we're on a different time scale from the conservation perspective or the restoration perspective. There are huge global commitments and processes going on to restore, you know, for example, with the Bond Challenge, 350 million hectares by 2030. That's a huge amount of land. And so people want to see things happen right away. But on the flip side, how is that going to happen? You have to work with the people on the ground. You have to understand the culture, the human relations to be able to figure out how people are going to actually integrate trees and forests into the landscape. And so I think there needs to be much more of an understanding about the importance of this kind of analysis and how critical it is to the restoration conservation process, and how it takes quite a long time to both gather that information and then be able to work with people to develop solutions that make sense to them. I don't think we're very patient in the approaches that we take. I think we want quick fixes and solutions because the issues are so dire. And, you know, they're so drastic, and we're really facing a turning point. And so it's a complex scenario. It's something I think about all the time, but we're seeing really amazing things happen when you do take this approach, this more bottom-up approach. You do look at the social cultural aspects. We're actually seeing incredible things happening on the ground that can be brought to scale, that can be accelerated in the landscape.
Excellent. I guess it's striking when you were talking there about the pace at which successful conservation and regeneration projects need to take place, and the pace at which the governments can operate and political decisions can be made, and the momentum that associated at the moment with dealing with some of these problems. Is that something you see?
Oh, definitely. You know, I am quite inspired by the commitments and the momentum, but I do worry that the strategies and the studies and the care and the time that's needed to develop meaningful and long-lasting solutions on the ground, I think the momentum and that process of bottom-up are not going to meet. I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure to meet the targets without the ability to do so in a meaningful way. And that's where, you know, our work with LT, we try to build that capacity at the local level and at different scales. And it does work. It's incredible to see how many people are doing really innovative, amazing things, but it takes time. And I'm very concerned that the time it takes, the resources it takes, are not going to match up with the pressures of meeting these commitments in such a timely manner.
So these are highly customized interventions, I suppose, in the sense that you're working with different people on the ground, different stakeholders, different power dynamics, different resources at stake, as it were. So can you talk a little bit about how you approach these, bringing together different groups, the stakeholders, and I guess the, you know, managing the governance of these change processes?
Yes, absolutely. And it is very site specific. Each country is different, each region is different, each community. And so you have to understand those aspects. You have to take the time to understand how the governance structure works at multiple scales. There are incredible organizations, you know, NGOs, research institutes, community organizations, associations who do this kind of work on the ground. And that's been LT's approach. We work with local partners who've been in some places where we work for decades. They have these relationships. They have this understanding of the culture, the ecology, the history, the power dynamics. And I think in that way, if you have groups coming together to with this knowledge, with different forms of knowledge, and build programs that can help build capacity to do restoration or conservation that fits within this local context, bring different resources together, different financial resources, different sources of knowledge. And knowledge can be, you know, scientific, but also traditional, you know, local knowledge, different kinds of wisdom from landholders. You really need to bring all these different things together. And so there are patterns. You know, you do see, for example, in cattle ranching landscapes, there are trends that you see in multiple places. There are strategies to increase tree and forest cover in those landscapes to increase the connectivity between forest fragments. So the technical aspects are very well understood and documented. There are agroforestry systems, there are civil pastoral systems, which integrate trees and shrubs into cattle ranching practices. So those techniques and strategies are out there. The science is there, but you have to understand the history of the people you're working with. You have to understand, how do they value and plant and protect and utilize trees and forests in their agricultural practices? Can you build upon that kind of experience? Who's making decisions? You know, who has the power? And how can you, you know, what are the entry points to try to increase sustainability in the long term? And so those are the timely processes that have to happen. But if we come together and draw upon the existing knowledges that are out there, the work that other organizations and individuals are doing, amazing things can really start to happen. And it can happen quite quickly. We have several examples of that within the cattle ranching context, for example, in Panama and Colombia, that are quite inspirational.
Right. That's very interesting. Maybe we can talk about those in a moment. Can you make any generalizations about how the approaches to conservation, to what extent they generally do include these variables, these groups, and take time? Because time is something, we live in a global economy where things move very fast. People want decisions fast. People expect, you know, supply chains to operate at pace, at speed, and things like that. I mean, the traditional approach to these questions, to what extent have they integrated the thinking and on the ground integrated these more bottom up and engaged kind of processes?
Yeah, there are many groups out there, non-governmental organizations that are doing this. They are taking this approach and they do some really incredible work. There's the Rainforest Alliance. There are, you know, Conservation International, the Nature Conservancy, USAID has a number of programs that they support that do take this bottom-up approach. Other organizations, national governments are supporting different groups doing this kind of work. I think the problem that we're seeing is the vast wealth and power of agribusiness, of the palm oil industries, where there's so much deforestation happening that is incentivized by national governments and corporations. We can't, you know, the bottom-up approaches cannot keep up with that kind of massive pressure and process that's happening at a scale. I find that to be the most overwhelming component of it, is how do you influence and try to change those land use decision-making practices? I think that's the biggest challenge.
And I guess there are, you know, vast sums of money involved here. And as you say, these are tightly coupled systems in many ways, you know, with the government, large agribusiness in some cases, and so forth, which have tremendous power. Are there any approaches that to managing governance in situations where people have such concentrated power? I mean, power seems to be one of those things where it's kind of zero sum, in the sense that, you know, for somebody to have it, somebody else has to give it up, or, you know, it's not additive in a sense, if you get what I'm saying. I'm just wondering, how do you deal with a situation where you're just dealing with a much more powerful and also, almost systemic power structure?
Yes, I think that's the million-dollar question. And I think, unfortunately, what we see with national governments, especially in tropical countries, you'll have conflicting policies and policies that relate to land use. So on the one hand, you'll have national governments with ministries of agriculture that promote mining and agricultural expansion into forested areas. It's incentivized. There are loans that enable you to do that. On the other hand, you have policies that try to protect forests and try to incentivize forests and forest conservation. That'll be within the same government, and those ministries don't speak to each other, or there's very little contact, and the agricultural or mining ministries will have far more power than an environment ministry. It's very complicated, and I think this is at the heart of so much of what we have to start focusing on. How do you address those power dynamics, sort of crack them open? I do not have an answer to that.
Yes. And I'm wondering if you can talk then about the governance. A lot of this, you know, it could be local, regional, national, but maybe at a supranational and a international level, are there any significant governance mechanisms, or do you think that the further development along those lines would be impactful?
So there's something called the Forest Regime Complex. So there's a professor here at the Forestry School, Professor Ben Kishore, who talks about this complex of forest governance at the global level. But there's not a single, you know, forest governance system. And so there are, you know, multiple systems you have out there. Some of them are legally binding, some of them are not. And I think that makes things quite complicated. I'm not a governance specialist, but there is a list of different kinds of systems and regimes out there. Perhaps if things were more cohesive, there could be systems that would help to change these, you know, often contradictory policies within a single government. I really don't have the expertise to know how that would happen. I think Professor Kishore could really give you some interesting insight into this.
Yes, that would be very interesting. Now, one of the things that you talked about is the working with local communities, working with different stakeholders, and so forth. And I think you also mentioned the word scaling. And how scalable are these kind of systems of, governance or systems?
Yes. So scaling up or bringing things to scale is the big hot buzzword of the moment, and it's because people, you know, things can happen at a farm level or at a very local level, but they want to know how you can replicate that and bring it up to the landscape level. So areas where you're protecting an entire watershed, not just one farm or two farms within that, so that you can try to conserve ecosystem services at a landscape level. And so I will say something that many people get frustrated with, but it depends. It all depends on the context. And in some cases, for example, we're seeing in Panama, there are new systems of sustainable cattle ranching where landholders are integrating trees and forests into their cattle ranching practices for a variety of different reasons. And we've been working with this group for about 10 years now, and they're traditional cattle ranchers that are you know, had deforested this region at one point. And so now what we're finding is that other communities in the region and other landholders are seeing what they're doing and are inspired by it. And so they're wanting to replicate those practices. And so they are now starting to establish similar systems. They're learning from these landholders. And we're starting to see these really innovative systems now coming to scale within this landscape. And so the national government in Panama has seen this success. They're really quite intrigued by it, and they are wanting to use this as an example for how to promote and scale up restoration in cattle ranching landscapes throughout the country. So that's a very particular case study. We've been working with this group and these landholders for over 10 years now. It's required a tremendous amount of effort, but the outcomes, the results that you're seeing are exactly the kinds of things that people want to see. And so I think if you take that care and you do work at that local level and understand what's important to people and build upon their existing knowledge, build upon, you know, where they see themselves in, you know, however many years, how trees and forests can help them to get there, then you start to see this sort of acceleration of innovation at varying scales.
Absolutely. Fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about some of the programs you run at LT and, you know, how they operate and what some of the outcomes?
Yes, absolutely. So we started as completely as a field-based training program, and our donor is Arcadia. They're a charitable fund of Lisbeth Rousing and Peter Baldwin. And they are, I have to say, one of the most I think insightful and an extremely wise philanthropy group, because they enabled us to basically figure it out for ourselves and explore what was available out there, what was on the ground, and build it up. And I think their flexibility and their trust in the people that they give these kinds of funds to really helps to develop solutions that are going to be long lasting. And so we started our field programs and we function in Panama, Colombia, Brazil, the Philippines, and Indonesia. And what we do is work within what we call training landscapes. And so we have local partners in those landscapes. Those can be research institutes, non-governmental organizations, also government ministries. We work with farmer cooperatives, all kinds of different organizations. And we work through those organizations to understand what kind of capacity development could help to accelerate conservation and restoration in human-dominated landscapes. And so we develop courses that are from a day-long to a week-long on a variety of conservation and restoration strategies for different stakeholder groups in those landscapes. Sometimes it's for one, sometimes it's for many. And we look at different kinds of approaches. So with cattle ranchers, we'll do an entire course on the importance of ecosystem services in tropical forests, and then the range of strategies that are available from very passive strategies, which involve setting areas aside to regenerate naturally, to actually doing tree planting and integrating trees into their cattle pastures. And so depending on what the interests are and depending upon the ecology and the culture and those power dynamics that we talk about, we will teach people how to do these different strategies so that they can decide, is this something that will work for them? And we bring in knowledge from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, but also from universities and research institutes, not only within the United States, but from around the globe. And very importantly, from our partner organizations in country. There's an incredible amount of wealth of knowledge and wisdom from local organizations and from local landholders. Our courses are experiential, so people go into the field and they learn by doing. We have demonstration areas. We visit landholders and farmers who are doing innovative things. people can learn from each other. So peer-to-peer learning, farmer-to-farmer learning is so important. And so we facilitate that. We also bring in experts from other countries. So we've had many experts come in from Brazil and Colombia, for example, to work in Panama, and they talk about their experiences. Then by the end of the course, a group of participants will work together. They'll develop a plan. How do they want to apply and share the knowledge that they learned during the course? And then once the course is over, we have something called a leadership program. So alumni of our training program will request leadership support to help them apply and share the knowledge that they learn. And this is really, I think, my favorite part of the program, because we get to listen to the people who are on the ground, and people will say, look, you know, there are a group of cattle ranchers. We really want to start a cooperative and set up some model farms. And so we can give them financial support to do that. We'll mentor them in the process, and we can give them technical support as well. And we'll also facilitate our partners or their connection to other sources of knowledge and experience in the regions where they are. And that's the most important thing. I think if you give people access to knowledge, you enable them to see how things are done, you let them talk to people, build networks, you can see things starting to happen on the ground. And that's how you accelerate. That's how you scale up. And so LT does this in a variety of different contexts. So in Panama and Colombia, we work primarily in cattle ranching landscapes. And so we're working with landholders and at different scales on integrating trees and forests into their agricultural and cattle ranching systems. In the context of the Philippines, we work entirely on native species reforestation. And so we are working primarily with communities who are looking to do reforestation to address disasters, so landslides and floods and all the adaptation components that reforestation can provide. And so we work with communities and municipalities to set up restoration and reforestation systems that are going to help support people's resilience to climate change and support their agriculture and their livelihood practices. In the context of Indonesia, we work in East Kalimantan, and we work with the mining companies who are doing coal mining, and we work with them to do the rehabilitation of coal mine sites. And so that's looking at lots of different approaches to restoration of highly degraded sites. And we also work within mangrove ecosystems, working with communities and other stakeholder groups to try to conduct mangrove restoration in a way that's technically feasible, but also supports community and local livelihoods.
Wow. Wow. Now, I did an interview some time ago with Jagdish Rao, who runs the Foundation for Ecological Security in India. And something like, I don't know, a quarter of the land in India is so-called wasteland, or land that doesn't belong necessarily to anyone. It tends to be, I guess, used by whoever's the most power in the local village and community. But they're about, bringing together, indigenous people, communities and other stakeholders to, regenerate the land and so forth. And he was very articulate and very persuasive about how long-term thinking that some of these indigenous communities and local people who when they're being offered, some kind of cash crops as part of the mix in a particular area, tend to not be so motivated by the shorter or medium term financial side of things, but just have a natural sense of longer term stakeholding, which I thought was very interesting.
Absolutely. And I think we don't give enough credit to the wisdom and the experience and perspectives, the long-term perspectives of local communities and indigenous and traditional communities. That can be a very powerful climate change mitigation strategy, is to strengthen community and traditional rights over natural resources. And there are many studies coming out that support that.
Yes.
That's where we need to be focused. We need to focus on the human aspect. And I do want to say one thing. I think it's, very easy to think about communities and the importance of integrating communities into conservation and restoration. But we also have to realize that communities aren't homogenous entities. They're very complicated with, components. There are power dynamics and people who have power and control over others. So we, you know, again, this is the part I think that frustrates policymakers, but it is complicated. You have to drill down and really understand what's going on here and what is the context, the history, the culture, and then try to understand what kinds of interventions will actually work and make sense for each particular area.
Yes. And how have you found working with agribusiness generally?
So we don't work with agribusiness per se. We work with the mining companies, which is a little bit different. They in Indonesia, they are mandated by law to do restoration. And so unfortunately, that can often mean putting trees in the ground and counting how many trees you planted, whether or not those trees survive, whether or not they're appropriate for that landscape, that's not the concern. So that, you know, I think the mining companies are becoming increasingly more interested in how do you do this well. And that's where LT steps in, working with the Ministry of Environment and Forestry and with an NGO called Tropenbos to try to make this happen. In the context of agribusiness, we haven't really hit that yet. We work mostly with landholders and people who are sort of on the ground trying to survive and are very interested in, you know, trying out new systems. They see a civil pastoral system that where you have, you know, in the dry season, so the tropics are, you know, have these very distinct rainy and dry seasons. And in the dry season, oftentimes cattle will die because they don't have food. But if you have a civil pastoral system where you have lots of trees that are fruiting at different times, they have different nuts and, you know, different shrubs that are full of protein, landholders will start to see, okay, people with these new interesting systems actually have cows that are healthy and thriving during the dry season, whereas their cows actually die. And so that has been our entry point, is just really being able to show people how interesting these systems are on the ground.
Well, that's very interesting, because and it's something that I came across in an earlier interview a couple of months ago. We tend to think of viral change or communications so much in the context of social media and technology, but there's an argument to be made that in local communities and in farming communities, the transfer of knowledge can be very rapid.
Yes, the transfer of knowledge is rapid. You need to again understand how people communicate, and in our case, it was, and in many cases, they communicate by seeing things on the ground, by talking to each other. They are not using social media in those cases.
No, absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
In other cases, they use radio. You know, radio is a very powerful instrument, I think, especially in many African countries, and music. You know, so you can have songs and traditional songs that are developed. Our partner in Colombia called CIPAV, they work on this quite a bit, where they have music that is about sustainable cattle ranching that is actually sending messages throughout these rural communities, and people are listening to it and actually assimilating that knowledge and then going and experimenting. So it depends. It depends on what the culture is and how they work.
Yes, I guess it was the idea that their welfare is at stake, you know, their livelihoods at stake. So they will be alert to, you know, what they can be doing better, that actually, you know, that sometimes they have an idea that, you know, that it's very primitive, that the farming hasn't changed and that it's, you know, quite static. But actually, it can change quite quickly as well.
It really can change quite quickly. I have seen it change, and our partners on the ground see it change. And actually, the farmers now who are making the change are our primary partners. So they are now teaching in the courses that we have. And so it's quite astounding to see what people will do, farmers and landholders and people who are surviving out there on the land and drawing upon natural resources are extremely innovative. You know, they will try new things. They will test it out. They will talk to each other and see what works. So we learn as much from them as they do from us. So we can bring to them, we can bring to them different strategies for integrating trees and forest in the landscape. But then for us, watching them take and assimilate that knowledge and integrate it into their traditional systems is, for me, the most fascinating part of it all. So we have farmers who have all these different kinds of model farms where they've done different things. You know, some of them are doing natural regeneration. Some of them are taking trees and integrating them into their crops in really different ways that we hadn't really thought about. That's the interesting and powerful aspects. People are quite amazing. They want to survive, and they want to adapt, and they're innovative.
It seems that the field-based work is at the heart of what you're doing. Can you talk a little bit about other approaches to capacity development?
Yes. So the field-based component, again, was LT's sort of bread and butter. We started that way and have built these programs where we have courses that run throughout the years, throughout the calendar year in our training landscapes. But in 2013, our principal investigator at the time, Professor Mark Ashton, had a very innovative idea, which has really taken off. And he wanted to try to figure out how could we reach more people out there. You know, the field courses are site specific. It takes time to get there. People have to take time out of their very busy lives. What could we do differently? So we launched an online training program that is based out of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And we have been able to reach over 1,000 people since starting in 2013 from about 70 different countries around the world. And these online courses build upon all of our experiences in the field. We have this incredible platform that we use that people can access. We have different case studies, different PowerPoint presentations. They're highly interactive. People can see each other and talk to each other. So we actually had one course. They're 6 weeks long. And so we had one course where we had Portuguese-speaking participants from Brazil working on restoration with Portuguese-speaking people from Mozambique. And they were connecting and interacting and talking about their experiences and sharing knowledge on an online platform. It was really powerful to see this. So we have a new program. We have, first of all, we have 6 week long courses that happen throughout the year. We have them in 5 different languages. They're not MOOCs, which are these massive online courses. They're highly interactive. They're tailored to the needs of the participants. Participants will actually develop a project during a course that is implementable at the end. And so they get a lot of very specific tailored guidance and mentorship throughout. But we also have a new 1 year online training program, and that is a certificate in tropical forest landscapes. And it's run in partnership with the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies and LT. And it's 4 8-week long courses, a project course that participants work on throughout, and then also a field component. So that's something. It's a course where people can actually, you know, work very comprehensively on developing their projects, and then they also interact and have this incredible network of Yale scholars, of all of our partners, but also each other. So we have a new cohort now of 44 people from 29 different countries, and they meet on a weekly basis, and it's a very dynamic, active program. So I think online training, you miss many of the people that you can only get through field programs. So you're not going to have a traditional farmer really being involved in an online program, but you do reach an entirely different group of people who are struggling, who are dedicated to doing conservation and restoration in the tropics. And those are the people that then are able to connect through online components. They're from NGOs, they're from government, from academia, and work together over the course of the year to develop a project.
Great, great. That sounds very powerful, use of technology. And what's next for you, Eva, at LT, but also, I guess, in your own work?
So I think for LT, and it's interesting, we're in our third phase right now. So we started in 2006, and we have a current support from Arcadia until 2022. And so we're thinking about, you know, what could LT look like? What could transpire afterwards, after we're finished with our third phase? And, you know, we have over 6,500 alumni of our training programs, both the field and the online programs. And these are people who have an incredible amount of knowledge, and they want to apply it and share it in different ways. And I think what we're really focusing on now is how do we reach these people? How do we support them to do just that, to apply and share the knowledge learned? We're thinking about potentially trying to establish a leadership institute where we can help people and support them to make impacts and have results on the ground. So that's something that's very exciting for us. We want to continue with the training aspects. We want to expand the online components. But I think really being able to reach out to the people who are contacting us all the time for support and mentorship to try to do things on the ground, those are the people that we also really want to connect with. So I see that as being in LT's future is trying to have these really sort of, you know, bring to scale the transformational results that you can have on the ground.
Well, I wish you the very best of success with it all. And thank you so much for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very grateful.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.